government. This morning we've got a number of bills that we're going to be considering, and we are starting a little bit late. This morning we'll start on a public hearing on House Bill 2532. Susie, would you kind of give us a little bit of history on 2532?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, this is a gut step of a previous bill to allow the agency to establish establishes a $400 non-refundable application fee for liquor licenses to recover a portion of the costs of the agency for issuing and monitoring those licenses throughout the year. And the bill requires a $400 application, non-refundable application fee be paid whenever there is a change in ownership of a brewery license, winery license, distillery license, wholesale malt beverage and wine license, warehouse license, brewery public house license, a limited on-premise sales license, an off-premise sales license, a grower sales privilege license, a full on-premise sales license. And there is a fiscal impact statement, which is there is no fiscal impact to the agency in collecting the revenue. There would be an increase in revenue for the 2003-05 biennium of $900,000 and then in 2005-07 of $1.2
million. Okay. Are there any questions of the legislative fiscal staff? This is a carryover of a couple of other bills that have been previously presented and have moved into other committees, which are now presently closed. And let's go ahead with public testimony and begin with Karen Gregory. Karen?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Karen Gregory. I'm the interim director of the Liquor Commission, and I'm pleased to be here before you this morning to fully support the amendments to House Bill 2532. As you know, this amendment creates an initial application fee that we feel would cover many of the state's costs of investigating applications for new liquor licenses or ownership changes of existing businesses. The fee would be payable when the application is filed with the commission. As you know, investigations, report writing, document review, data entry, and decision making all take time and are costly for the state. We feel that this bill goes a very long way in covering many of the actual costs of issuing a new liquor license. And the fees created by this amendment would allow us to maintain our present staff to provide timely and thorough customer service for our license applicants. With our current staff, it takes between 30 and 60 days to complete an initial investigation for a new license, depending on the complications with that license. Under the proposed agency staffing cuts, that timeline now increases to 90 to 120 days. It's way too long to keep business people waiting on a decision. And even though we've been going through a recession in Oregon, our licensing work has been still increasing year after year. So this amendment is really a question of dollars versus days. It costs the new business owner $400 to have their application done in a timely manner, and they don't have to wait that 90 to 120 days because we'll have the staff to continue doing the work that we've done. State laws require the Liquor Commission to conduct licensing investigation for years. But since the 1950s, our costs have outpaced our revenue. Most of our license fees were established 50 years ago, and the legislature had a budget note in the year 2000 that asked us to streamline our licensing process. We did that. We went from 34 licenses down to 12. We took a look at licensing fees, and we ended up raising one fee from $50 to $100 for the off-premise sales license. Other than that, our license fees have actually remained unchanged for five decades. It's woefully inadequate to recoup our modern-day investigative and administrative cost of issuing a license. So, in closing, House Bill 2532, as amended, would recover our licensing costs while keeping our licensing fees reasonable for all Oregonians. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Other questions for Ms. Gregory? let me just make sure I understand the background, Karen. The cost to issue the license presently for the full on-premise is about $913. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
What's the current charge presently in statute
for that? For an off-premise, Mr. Chair?
Yes, for an on-premise full.
Mr. Chair, there is no application fee. The license fee is $400.
Okay. And it's my understanding that this would then add the $400 because the estimated cost is about $913.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And then also on an on-premises limited, the cost is about $655, leaving a difference right now of $455 off-premises or off-premises sales, $698, leaving a difference on that annual fee presently of $598. Senator Winters, recognized?
Just a point of clarification, just to make certain I'm clear on this, that it's for new licenses, as I understand, and existing licenses, if they're not making their renewal within the 20-day period. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, it's for new license applications and change of ownerships only.
So if you're late, that's not a new license?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, Senator?
Then subsection 3, page 1. That assessment fee, that's not the $400 or the $200. It's just a fee that you determine based on what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, it is a late fee, and I will have to ask one of our staff members to answer what it's based on. You know the answer?
Yeah, I know.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, it's 25% of the annual license fee is the late fee.
And that remains unchanged under subsection 2.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions from Ms. Berger? Thank you very much, Karen. Stand by. We probably will need you on another issue here. Mary Blotkin?
Members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Mary Bodkin with AFSCME Council 75, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I don't have a dollar with me. But, you know, I'm good for it.
No, it's okay.
I'm good for it. We're just here to very briefly offer our support for the increase in license fees. Several years ago, we worked with the industry and the agency to kind of revamp and change the licensing process and combine licenses and feel very good that we were able to do some really good interim work at consolidating licenses and kind of streamlining the process. We think that the fee increase is very critical to the agency so that legitimate law-abiding businesses can continue to function and serve liquor in the manner in which they're supposed to, and we think this bill will allow us to do that in a timely manner. And I just have to say that of all the agencies that we represent, this is one of the best to work with. I have a friend who purchased a bar, and you know, it's just amazing to me. When she took over the bar, when she and her partner took over the bar, they never lost one day of business in dealing with the OLCC. They got a temporary license immediately. They moved into the process and got their regular license in a timely manner. They never had to shut down the bar at all. And 6 months later, they're still waiting for the Lottery Commission to finish its process. You know, I'm thinking that the lottery could take some lessons from the liquor light and liquor folks. And but, you know, that would be another story on another day. So, anyway, we support the liquor license increase, the licensing increases, and think it makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Blocken? Thank you, Mary. Representative Patridge, would you like to explain? Did you provide a copy of that by any chance?
I didn't. I just gave Susie copies of this. I think that, Mr. Chair, there's support from people that I've talked to in the industry. I think that part of the concern, though, is if they raise the fee, that it gets processed in a timely manner. And I have some amendments that were drafted as to another bill that weren't in this particular draft, and I think Susie and I missed each other a little bit like this, so we're trying to get those. But basically the draft, I think probably the easiest way is to hand, maybe to photocopy it and hand it out at a time later, but basically that the commission denies the application or grants the application, but imposes one or more restrictions to the license. The commission does not give notice to the applicant of the commission's action within 60 days from the date the commission receives the completed application, basically saying that they'll pay the $400 if the commission does it within 60 days. They're required to pay it within 60 days.
So they wouldn't pay it?
They need to process it within the 60-day period. Okay. Excuse me.
And then would there be a refund if it's not processed within the 60 days?
That is my understanding.
Okay. Maybe we'd have Bill Perry from the Restaurant Association come forward and maybe explain that. We will get copies of this and carry this over as well.
For the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association. The amendment that I don't have it in front of me that Representative Patridge is discussing, it actually isn't a refund. It would be a credit to future license applications. And so you'd pay the $400 if you didn't get it within the time frames outlined within the statute, then the OLCC would keep the money, but for future license payments, you would be able to credit that $400 towards your future license applications. And much like the representative from OLCC spoke, one of the concerns that our members have is this, as of right now, you're supposed to be getting your license within 30 to 60 days, and because of multiple reasons, they're not happening. If you're a change of ownership, you can get a temporary. If you're not a change of ownership, you sit there without operating for long periods of times. And there's examples. I actually just got a letter. I made a photocopy to bring down here of somebody that's been waiting for a license for over 90 days. And from our standpoint, that's not acceptable. From our members, it's not acceptable. And so we're willing to work partway to make sure that we can get additional monies to the OLCC. But for that, we need to have some guarantees that the problem's going to get fixed, or we don't see like we want to pay the same amount of or more money for the same service we're getting today. So
I guess the concern I have with that bill is that, as you're aware, we've got some regulatory cuts coming in the agency. But those folks are still there. And so if you haven't received a license after 90 days, and I still have full staff, then that's of concern to me. Does that concern your members?
I guess I don't completely understand your question.
Well, the concern is presently that what we're trying to do is we're trying to get enough resources back into the kitty here to assist in bringing the regulatory staff back on. The proposed budget cuts like 10 positions, regulatory positions. This $400 would restore something around 4 to 5 of those employees, less than half of them.
Mm-hmm.
If presently with full staff, you've got somebody that's been waiting for 90 days, that's of concern to me because we're not getting the job done now.
Mm-hmm.
Where will we be if we cut the staff in half?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do think what this does is it does reinstate some of those positions by adding more money to the kitty. And also, it does not remove the money from the OLCC if the license isn't met. They still get to hold the money. It would only be for future incoming payments that it could impact it. From our standpoint, is if I'm not opening, I'm not selling alcohol, doing a lot of other things that are basically bringing in the money. And so I think the quickest we can get those establishments up and running, all of us are going to benefit. OLCC, everything else. So,
specific questions for Mr. Perry. I'm a little anxious about it. You see where I'm coming from, Bill, or am I making myself clear on this? Because if we're fully staffed today, and you've got folks that have been waiting 90 days for a license, then by the time we cut 10 positions and then restore half of those positions through this budget, through this particular bill, then it looks like, you know, most everybody would be waiting 90 days if we can't get it done in 90 days now. Is there some specific circumstance under this current applicant that you've got that's creating the 90-day problem that you know of?
Not any specific ones. I would say it's not a specific. I've heard of several different ones, and it really is from the time period of the economy and everything else. I think trying to get people up and running should be the main priority.
I think that has been the priority. My concern is that this in effect creates a $400 receipt, but it also creates a $400 penalty against the agency if they can't get it done within the 60 days. You're telling me right now with full staff they can't get it done within the 60 days, then I don't know if we're going to get it done in 60 days after the budget.
Except that this is adding more money to the kitty. This is not taking any current money they have away. I mean, so...
Right, but our budget as presently constituted for the OLCC does take that money away. This restores a portion of the money that we're taking away for the regulatory process.
Well, and I don't know if this does anything to the regulatory budget. It only does the licensing budget. I don't think this does anything with the regulatory budget, would be my understanding.
Okay. I need some clarification on that because I thought that it did assist with the whole process to bring us back up to speed. The regulation could... There was a process, or part of the process was stuck in the regulatory process to get it through with the entire licensing process. So I just want to make sure from the OLCC standpoint that we're not, that we're going to still be okay with this $400 and with this proposal.
Okay, because my understanding is the portion that we had talked about was we will buy off on this fee as long as we were guaranteed that some of the licensing positions were reinstated. And that's
right.
Really what I'm looking for is I don't mind going back because, you know, my members don't want the fee increase just like anybody else does. But at the same time, 90 to 120 days when you're waiting to open a restaurant is not acceptable.
Right.
So there is some give and take here, and we feel this is a good way to be kind of in the middle.
Let's get a response from the agency.
You want me to stay? Or?
Yeah, why don't you stay, Bill, and then we can have questions of you as well.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Karen Gregory, Interim Director for the Liquor Commission, and I appreciate your question about fully staffed. Currently, as you know, our budget has not actually cut with those positions until July 1st. However, we have had a state freeze on hiring. So as other positions have been available throughout the agency, people in these positions who were scheduled to be laid off just July 1st have taken those other positions. So we are now down in licensing alone, three licensing positions, a number of support staff positions, a manager. So we are really at the July 1st staffing level. And what Mr. Perry is alluding to is exactly what will be happening to most licenses. It will take 90 to 120 days.
But Karen, you're comfortable that with the restoration of the positions that we would be able to put through, if this becomes law, that you would be able to meet the 60-day requirements?
Mr. Chairman, we believe that we can meet the 60-day requirement as long as all written application forms are complete when they come into the agency and all documentation from the license applicant has been received, and the clock should start ticking at that point.
Have you seen the language of this proposed amendment so that we know that the application is, in fact, complete? Bill, does it have complete application language in it?
Chairman, Bill Perry at the Restaurant Association, I'm trying to find it. It's in here twice.
So that we do, in fact, have a completed application, all systems go, then at that particular point the clock starts.
Yeah, it's on line 8. It says the commission receives a properly committed application, and it also says it in Section B at the end, the commission receives a properly completed application.
Okay.
So the timeline would not start
until that completed application.
And there is a question of whether or not it should say that or application as authorized under rule. There was a question with that, and legislative council obviously chose this way.
Karen, let me just ask this relative to the process within the agency. If an application has been completed but it's not properly completed, do you have written communications back and forth, or is it pick up a telephone, and what's this information that we need here? Tell me what that process is, if I could, relative to licensing.
Mr. Chairman, it depends on the individual license investigator and what kind of information is not there. Sometimes if there's a lot of information not there, we'll send the whole packet back with notes on what the applicant needs to do. Some license investigators will make phone calls. They'll write letters. There's really a number of
I think it's going to be very, very incumbent, particularly where we're dealing with, in effect, it becomes a $400 penalty to the agency. I think it becomes very incumbent upon the agency to make certain that all aspects of that application are in writing when we're waiting for, you know, where did you work for the last 5 years or something like that, and that's left blank, or it's otherwise not complete at that particular point. My concern is that the application, the 60-day time can start taking against it. Senator Winter.
Mr. Chair, just a question, because you're talking about the three positions will go away as of July, and are we having a dramatic increase in the number of new facility or new licenses currently? And how does that, if I took the increase, what does that equate into position needs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, over the last number of years,
I'm talking about current.
Right. We have had increases in licensing for new outlets. In the year 2000, there were 544, 2001, 684, 2002, 793.
These are not renewals. These are all new.
These are brand new outlets.
How many was in 2001?
684.
So from 2000, we're down to 600. What I'm trying to get at is that, you know, what the actual workload, if we're talking about these positions, and
these are new applications, is that right?
That's correct.
Give me those numbers again, if you would, please, starting with 2000.
544 in the year 2000, 684 in the year 2001, and 793 in 2002. And then we also have changes of ownership.
How many, the three positions, what will the increased revenue purchase for you? Three positions, four positions, how many positions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it's $1.2 million, and it will get us eight positions back.
So eight of the ten you anticipate would be restored?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And those would be dedicated to the licensing staff?
It's licensing staff, it's the manager, and it's also support staff.
Okay. Senator Winters, follow-up?
Follow-up. Are those the positions that you're actually eliminating now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, they
are. And are those positions pretty much dedicated to the licensing activity?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, yes, they
are. And not the other side of the regulatory investigating.
Okay. I'd just like a brief response to the fact that we may have completed applications presently that are over 90 days. Is that that's your understanding that we may have that?
Mr. Chairman, it is my understanding that is a possibility. Most of those would be problem premises, premises that have been problems in the past that may have a new owner, and it takes a lot of investigation to make sure that the new owner is going to run it in a proper way. So,
and we have a reduction in that licensing staff, which has caused this problem.
That's correct.
Okay. Further questions of either Mr. Perry or Ms. Gregory at this point? Thank you very much. Thank you both very much. We'll go ahead and, Bill, if we can get that language back, we'll go ahead and circulate that. What let's do is let's plan to go ahead and carry over the public hearing and the work session. Well, let's carry them both over, the public hearing possible work session on House Bill 2532 to tomorrow, June 17th at 8:30. So let's go ahead and publish that, and we'll at that time we'll receive the in the form of a potential amendment with some co-chair sign-off on it, that which Representative Patridge is presently having copied, and we'll work with Legislative Fiscal. So with that, we'll go ahead and close and carry over the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2532 until tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you, Mary, for the contribution to American Cancer Society. Okay. We'll now open a, let's see, we're short again. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3442 relating to the Oregon Wine Board. Of the subcommittee of the subcommittee.
No sign-ups.
No sign-ups on the House Bill 3442. We have two sets of amendments that have been presented. Adrian, are you prepared to give us a brief introduction on 3442? I recognize that you're pinch hitting for Susie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll leap in as best I can. the Ingross version of the bill that you have in front of you is set up to transfer into a semi-independent status the current Oregon Wine Advisory Board, which is a component of the Department of Agriculture. The measure, again, as a semi-independent agency, would create the wine board subject to the usual exclusions of operation from statute that other semi-independent agencies experience, with an exception, and that is that its budget, instead of simply being a report to the governor and the legislature, for informational purposes, it would still have to go through the same kind of process to adopt by itself, but the governor would provide a review and approval process on an annual basis. So where the semi-independent status agencies today prepare a biennial budget and adopt it through a public hearing process and simply turn that in for our examination, but nothing more, the governor would actually be allowed to review it, provide some input as to the direction the governor feels the strategies and uses of the funds would be appropriate back to the wine board to incorporate in its budget. The fiscal impact statement that you have reflects the expenditures reduction at the Department of Agriculture, a bit of a change at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, because the Liquor Control Commission would be responsible for auditing and collecting the tonnage tax paid on wine grapes that are exported from Oregon. And there are other agencies mentioned in the measure that would have some involvement in that budget setting process, but there really would be no expenditure issues with them. I would also note that the measure would become effective on passage, and that the provisions of the semi-independent status would be operative on July 1, 2003, or 20 days after the passage of the measure, which is a little unusual. When we turn agencies loose, we usually do it on either the start of the biennium or the start of a fiscal year, and I think it might be helpful to find out from the agency folks whether there are whether it's ready to move into that status. I think it might be a useful discussion.
Why don't we go ahead? Do we have someone here from? Well, let's make sure that we're okay with regard to the OLCC on that 824 tipping fee for the out-of-state wine. Do we have anyone on behalf of the OLCC that can give us an update on that? On $824.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Merle Lindsay, Director of Administrative Services for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And in regards to the $800, I believe that would be the additional expense the Liquor Commission would incur in mailing out the forms to the vineyards that sell their grapes out of state.
Okay, and that $824 is an additional expense to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding.
Okay. There's no no new resource created there. That's within your current budget that you can meet that obligation.
Mr. Chair, that's correct as well. We can absorb that.
All right. Thank you very much, Merle. Let's take a look at the A3 amendments. Adrian, you were talking about the governor having the oversight. The A3 amendments provide that, the director of the Economic and Community Development Department has the oversight in lieu of the governor on page 4. Are you prepared to discuss that? It's all the A3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I am not. I think, and if there's somebody from Economic and Community Development, I do see at least a couple of faces in the back to be able to respond to that.
Do we have someone from the Economic and Community Development that's prepared to respond to that? Doris, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and perhaps best positioned to explain the A3 amendment. In my previous testimony, I noted that as this bill was being considered in House rules, we were having a discussion with the governor's office about the particular provision involving the governor's review and approval or disapproval of a strategic plan. The governor's office, subsequent to the movement of the bill to this committee, indicated its preference to designate an agency. The preference of the Oregon wine industry is the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and the A3 amendment was drawn, again, in consultation with the department to fulfill the governor's wishes.
Yes, Representative Johnson is recognized.
I'm curious, when you say, Mr. Conkling, that the preference of the industry was OECDD, why? I mean, there seems to be a much more natural nexus with the Department of Agriculture, or give me the rationale behind OECDD.
Mr. Chair.
There's the book, by the way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. In fact, there is a great deal of connection between the industry and this agency because of marketing reasons, promotion, its involvement in Brand Oregon. Really, the most critical need of our industry these days is market promotion. Our research work is done almost exclusively with Oregon State University, with not a great deal involvement with the Department of Agriculture. Again, as I previously testified, there's no animosity here. This isn't an unhappy divorce. It has nothing to do with that. The department has been terrific. We've done this in consultation with the director. It's just that this is the best fit for our industry.
Thank you very much, Gary. And on behalf of the OECDD, you own that acronym, Representative Johnson. So
thank
we'll
you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell, representing the Economic and Community Development Department. When this bill was proposed, we had a brief conversation with the governor's office, Department of Agriculture, and the representatives testifying today. And we agreed that if, at the end of the session, the department has a budget and an arrangement that allows us to continue to operate as we would like to, especially with the Brand Oregon emphasis that the governor wants to place on a number of our agencies and stepping forward, that the department would be able to perform the function that is requested by the wine board. It would require, as you can note in the amendments, the department coordinating some of the strategic planning, reviewing the budget, and providing any support that is necessary to be sure that the work can proceed for the wine board. I think it's the governor's preference that they not do any substantive operational work out of the governor's office, but that the agencies are involved rather than the governor directly. So we agreed to step forward and provide that sort of coordinated activity.
Thank you very much. This is something that your department is prepared to do.
We can do that.
Representative Johnson? Sure.
Thank you. As long as we have both of these experts here, I'd like to follow up on LFO staff's suggestion that we explore a little more deeply the 30 days. Having been very involved in the creation of an agency, I know that it took us the better part of a year to get all of the fiscal oversights worked out. Tell me how you're going to pull us off in 30 days, and who's going to do the accounting functions, the personnel functions, the payroll, all of the nuts and bolts of running the operation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the wine industry has been involved in planning this transition for almost 2 years. There is a fairly substantial business plan going on. There have been meetings. In fact, there is a meeting on June 27th to effect a bylaw and other changes relative to this in anticipation of the approval of House Bill 3442. So we are prepared. The beginning of our fiscal year, incidentally, is July 1, which is why the reason for the mention of the change. That is our hope that we can start our new fiscal year in our new form.
Thank you. Further questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson?
Then, as a semi-independent agency, are you going to be doing your own payroll, your own fiscal reporting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I believe the answer is yes to those things. We're by and large, the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, which currently exists today, fundamentally handles most of those activities already. It is a fairly self-contained unit, so most of the functions that you would normally associate with this are already in place.
That response from Ms. Johnson.
I guess just at the risk of beating this to death, one more question, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please.
Assuming I'm an employee of the wine board, what's my check stub going to look like? Who's paying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you know, that's a question that I, in all honesty, I can't tell you absolutely, but my assumption it would be the Oregon Wine Board.
Okay, and does the Oregon follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Does the Oregon Wine Board then, in effect, I guess I'm having a little trouble understanding where the side boards of semi-independent state agency are. Will the employees be state employees to the degree that they're eligible for PERS? Will this be a 501c3 so you're eligible to accept external donations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, Jim Bruneau is here, who has played a large role in working on this at a level of detail greater than myself. Would you object to
Why don't we have Jim come up and...
I think he can provide more satisfactory answers.
Maybe Legislative Fiscal has some idea. It's my understanding under 3442 that the Wine Commission, the members themselves, would be prohibited from participating. They're not public employees. But does Legislative Fiscal have an idea what this would look like immediately following?
Mr. Chair, I apologize that I do not, because I have not read the bill in sufficient detail.
What do other semi-independent agencies look like?
Mr. Chair and committee members, semi-independents are state agencies, and the language that goes with them is created at the time that they are set loose. Most, if not all, to my recollection, have the employees retaining all of their employee rights in PERS and in other programs that they have been subject to while a full-fledged state agency. The most recent one was the Landscape Contractors Board, and it specifically allowed that they would continue in those roles. There is often language that indicates that that they are still subject, however, down the road to any further new negotiations if they are represented employees and other kinds of provisions that would typically be associated with management responsibility. And perhaps Mr. Bernot could speak to some of those details.
Also, as we look at the Legislative Fiscal Office report, it appears that all of the existing folks that would be pulled out of the Department of Agriculture are all subject to the PICs and other systems, personnel system, services and supplies, and the other issues, Representative Johnson. So my guess is that the semi-independent agency still leaves them as a state agency. Mr. Bernal?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Bernal. I'm the president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, but also serve on the Oregon Wine Advisory Board as its promotions chair. And I've worked for the last 2.5 years on this reformation of the Oregon wine industry's services. These are good questions and actually strike at the heart of the reasons why we're seeking a change. This bill actually includes a provision that makes the Oregon Wine Board not eligible for inclusion in the public employment retirement system. And one of the reasons why we sought that is that our employee load is very high. It ranges between 47% and 52%. As the board is presently constituted under the Department of Agriculture, that's in addition to our labor costs. And so we were looking at ways of reducing those costs. The folks that are active in our industry and are involved in the activities of this providing of this service are not motivated by this particular benefit, and therefore it's a cost that we believe the industry would like to forego. We are prepared to make the change on July 1st. There's 3 employees presently in this organization, and so the accounting is very simple. There has been quite a bit of research that has been applied by the present staff. The administrator of the Oregon Wine Board Advisory Board, the industry is recommending to become the temporary administrator of the new board. So there's going to be a nice, smooth transition in staffing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
It's Monday morning, and I need more help than usual. Would you cite the language? Where in the bill are you reading that speaks to the question of the PERS?
It's on page 3 of the bill, section 6, line 7, and it goes down to the portion that's line 10, sub 2. It says, notwithstanding section 3 of 1 of this, so on, employees of the Oregon Wine Board are not eligible for inclusion within the public employee retirement system.
And so I'm trying to understand, Mr. Chair, how the mechanics of this are going to work. You have 3 people currently that are state employees.
We have actually 2 of there's one that is paid. Our director is paid because she's a temporary. She's held that position temporarily. She's presently not participating in PERS, and so there's 2 individuals that are.
And this bill then strips those employees of their PERS status.
That's correct.
And that's been discussed with the employees?
Oh, yes. Yes, the employees understand the industry's desire to make this change.
Okay. So, may I
follow up, please?
So, as part of your semi-independent status, then you'll be setting your employment relationship with these folks?
Yes. Presently, they're employees of the Department of Agriculture.
Right. And so, then detail for me, if you would, in what respects you expect your agency status and all the privileges associated with agency status, in what respects do you expect your agency-ness to continue? And can you detail in what respects you anticipate your new private status to be manifest?
This Oregon Wine Board will certainly be a semi-independent board and agency, and it will have a 501c3 and a 501c6. So it'll have different elements within this board, which to draw its its opportunities and functions from. It will have the number of employees it presently has, and it will have to engage in new employment agreements with those employees once the its law becomes effective.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, please, Representative.
Do you anticipate you're going to be subject to the open meetings laws?
Oh, absolutely.
And your books available for public inspection?
Most certainly. The staff has done research for about the last 6 months with other semi-independent board directors, agency directors, to learn of their accounting procedures and the methods in which they're presently complying with state law.
Well, the one piece that I still don't quite understand is this bill is, or the concept in this bill is proposed to solve a certain problem. I'm not sure that I have a clear definition of the problem.
The Oregon Wine Board is a result of about a 2.5-year effort by the industry to strengthen its leadership and to focus its resources on its tackling its issues. The one thing we found was we found difficulty in doing that with the Oregon Wine Advisory Board serving in the Department of Agriculture. The employees were employees of the Department of Agriculture. They reported to the director of the Department of Agriculture, but were really intending to serve the Oregon Wine Advisory Board, appointees of the director on the board. We felt that after considerable research that we would be better, more effective as a board, as an agency, if the employees actually reported to the board of the agency. And so that was one of the fundamental changes that's included in this. The other change, and you see the reason why we have the PERS write-out in this bill, is because of the very high labor costs that we're experiencing and how those precious funds could be used more effectively for promotion or for research for the industry. So the benefits we feel will come to the industry from this change will be significant. We'll have appointments made by the governor rather than by the director of the Department of Agriculture. We'll have a staff that reports to the board of the agency rather than to another authority figure in a department, another department. We'll be able to collect the various activities of the industry's promotions and research under one central focus. The reason why we have this provision that has the Department of Economic Development Director's review came from the Attorney General. The industry actually reluctantly accepted this opinion of his, but here the Attorney General's view was that we should have the review of a state director, an agency director, or the governor, to provide defense for, I think, a case you're very familiar with, the U.S. Foods case. And so that's the reason why that provision is in this in these amendments.
One last follow-up.
Please.
In general, Mr. Bruno, how do you feel about semi-independent state agencies?
Mr. Chairman, with respect to this proposal, I am deeply devoted to it and have spent 2.5 years of my professional life working on it with my colleagues in the industry. We have the work that has gone into this and the unanimity of which we've achieved is unprecedented in our industry. We have something in the nature of 120 principals of wineries and vineyards who have signed on to this proposal, physically signed on to it. It's remarkable.
But as you well know, semi-independent state agencies have fallen under some recent criticism.
Yes, I understand.
Thank you.
I guess my concern is that really when most of the attributes that you've defined are really not semi-independent, but are independent state agencies where they hire and fire and really don't have the association with the state, Jim, similar to the Oregon Bar Association or Oregon Health Sciences. Is the wine advisory set up as a nonprofit corporation, or is that just maintaining its agency status and going to rename that agency status as a semi-independent?
Well, it's the latter, Mr. Chair. The proposal is to take this step to move from the Department of Agriculture into a semi-independent board status, to better provide the services that we believe the state has an interest in providing, which is research to promote the industry as well as its marketing support.
Are there further questions for Mr. Bonneau or Mr. Conkling?
No, just a procedural question. Are we going to plan to work session?
That's an excellent, question. And now that we've got a full quorum here, let's go ahead. Thank you very much. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3442 as they engrossed. You have the A3 amendments to the bill, which basically bring the Oregon Economic, the Director of the Economic and Community Development Department to stand in the stead of the Governor as the bill presently provides. We each have a copy of the Dash A3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3442.
You've heard the motion. Are there any objections to moving the Dash A3 amendments? Hearing and seeing none, we'll order those appended. Now, there's also an amendment which is provided, Dash A4, which was proposed early on to move the 2 cents presently being received by the advisory, Oregon Wine Advisory, and the proposal was to move it to the general fund. And we do not have consensus between the chairs and the speaker at this particular point as to how that would happen or when that would happen. Is there any discussion about the A4? I do not intend to move those at this time. Any discussion? Hearing and seeing none, we won't do anything with the A4 amendments. We now have the 3442 as amended, or as amended with the dash A3.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3442 as amended by the A3 amendments to the full Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
You've heard the recommendation. Is there any objection to that? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Representative Devlin, will you carry it to the full and to the Senate? Representative Patrick, would you take this to the House? We will go ahead then and move that then as directed. And we will close then on House Bill, the work session on House Bill 3442 as amended. We'll open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3023. Dallas?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3023 was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This bill changes the time frame which agencies must transfer their accounts that are liquidated and delinquent. Right now the law is 1 year. They have to transfer to the Department of Revenue or to a private collection agency. And this bill would change it to 90 days. But allows for the Department of Administrative Services to adopt some rules to exempt certain agencies from the 90-day rule. I can check and see if there's someone signed up for this.
Please, Governor. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, while he's looking, I just think it's an improvement over what we started out with.
Every amendment seems to be an improvement, I hope, Senator.
We have no amendment.
As you are aware, Mr. Chair, we tried to get our collections, those debts that are owed to us, collected in a very expeditious and forthright way, and this is just another step.
Okay. Signed up to testify during the public hearing portion is Matt Marquis, Oregon Collector Association.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association, testifying in support of House Bill 3023. This is the first time I've testified in front of your subcommittee, Mr. Chair, and I know I'm going to screw up on the Ackerman, so I'm just going to go ahead and start with $5. Yeah, and you let me know how I do.
I have him back, Mr.
Chair. Just to give you a brief history of where we're at, we've been working on the issue of state receivables since the late 90s. In 1997, during the interim, we worked with the Senate Budget Committee and did a complete inventory of the state receivables and found $1.8 billion owed to the state at that time. And we also found that state agencies had a hard time coming up with some of the information that the Senate Budget Committee was asking of them as far as how much was owed to the state, how old their accounts were, how many accounts they had, and such. So in 1999, legislation was introduced with the help of Senator Winters and with the help of Senator Bryant at the time that first required state agencies to report to the Legislative Fiscal Office on the status of all their liquidated and delinquent accounts annually. They're required to show how much is owed to the state agency, how many accounts they have, how much was added throughout the year, and their ending balance. The legislation also required that when a state agency had a liquidated and delinquent account that did not receive a payment in 1 year, that they had to turn that account over to a private collection agency. Now, that's current law now, and that's important to remember. It's one payment within the year. So once they receive a payment, that one-year time frame starts over. And in some circumstances, the one-year time frame actually lasts longer as well due to other laws such as state or federal. From the private collection agency's standpoint, our recovery rates could be increased greatly by doing a few things. First one is speeding up the time frame. Secondly, would be allowing us to sue, because currently we are not able to sue on these accounts when they're turned over to us. And then thirdly, would be to allow the cost of collection to be added to the accounts. We've been working with the Attorney General's office, who has agreed to allow us to start suing on these accounts when they're under $5,000 in small claims court. They're currently working with Department of Administrative Services to develop rules to allow us to do so. This will be a huge help for us. House Bill 2055 has already passed the legislature and has become law, which would allow state agencies and other local governments to add the cost of collections to a receivable when it's turned over to a private collection agency. There was some concern by the governor with the unconstitutionality of this legislation. He agrees with the concept, but was worried that some state agencies might use this provision unconstitutionally in the contract law. We are currently working with Representative Patridge on trying to get some opinions from legislative counsel on how we might be able to solve these concerns if there are any legitimate concerns. And if the committee is so desired, we would like to use this bill as a vehicle to try and make those changes if legislative counsel so desires or says that we need to make some. What House Bill 2023 does is speeds up the one-year time frame. The first provision would allow would require a state agency to turn a liquidated and delinquent account that has not received a payment in 90 days either to a private collection agency or to the Department of Revenue. If the account goes to a private or goes to Department of Revenue, Department of Revenue would have an additional 90 days to try and collect a payment. And then at that time, after 6 months of no payment, the receivable would then have to be turned over to a private collection agency. It's important here again to remember that these time frames are all based on the date of last pay. So once a penny or a nickel is paid on one of these accounts, the time frame starts over. There's a whole list of exemptions currently in law of different types of accounts that would not be turned over to private collection agencies. And House Bill 3023 adds another provision that gives a blanket exemption to Department of Administrative Services to exempt certain types of accounts from being turned over to a private collection agency. But in no circumstance could that this new exemption be longer than the one-year current time frame. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good questions for Matt Markey.
No, but I'd just like to make a comment that in debt collection, the longer the debt stays, the more difficult it becomes to collect the debt. And when we started this and working with the Marquis when I came in 99 and working with Senator Neil Bryant, we looked at what a $1 billion amount that was owed to the state, and some of those accounts have been sitting there for years. And I think it's good that we now are recognizing that we need to have a more speedy process in order to go after the debtor. Truly it is dollars that are owed the state, and truly, here we are in a in the economy where every dime that we could get could certainly help me and my committee that I have in human services. So I'm still continue to be supportive of the effort of getting our debt collected and back in the general fund where it belongs.
Senator, thank you very much. The concerns expressed relative to the letter from Governor Kulongoski regarding the potential contract clauses, the potential violation of contract clauses in the U.S. and Oregon constitutions. Matt, are you proposing that somehow we work that out? Representative Patrick, I'll let you respond to that.
Mr. Chair, we've requested from Legislative Council an opinion to look at House Bill 2055 in light of the governor's concerns and to try and work with the governor's office and the Attorney General's office in regard to any potential problems that could be fixed. And this would be the perfect vehicle to fix those issues in. We anticipate that we should get that back. And notify the chair.
Okay.
Well, hopefully they'll say that it does need to be fixed, but we'll, if it does, we'll notify you immediately when we get the LC opinion back, Mr. Chair. And I think that that's how we want to handle it. And, both Marquis are handling the situation and staying on top of that in regard to the AG opinion.
All right. Mr. Chair, if I can just respond to both of those, actually. As far as the governor's concerns on the unconstitutionality, I believe it's mostly with the due process issue of giving notice prior to adding these fees. And we spelled some provisions out in the bill. He might not have felt they went far enough, and we just want to check with Legislative Council and see if there's any need to add additional provisions for some additional notice prior to adding these fees. And in comment to Senator Winter's comments on the time frame, I just want to bring up that while we have currently a one-year time frame in statute, most of these accounts that come to us are well over a year old by the time they get to us. And by changing the time frame to 6 months, I would guess that we're probably going to be closer to the one-year time frame than a six-month time frame.
Thank you, Matt. We also have signed up to testify John Dufresne and Susan Browning. Would you folks like to come forward, please? John Dufresne from the Department of Administrative Services, Susan Browning from the Department of Revenue.
I might as well leave it out.
Okay, let's see. John, you're signed up first. Issues from the Department of Administrative Services?
Yes, I'm John Dufresne from the Department of Administrative Services, State Controller's Office.
I have a handout here for you.
And rather than to go ahead and read through the testimony, I'd just like to go right straight to the exhibits. And talk about what we've done. As Senator Winters indicated, House Bill 3509 started the process of taking a stronger look at our liquidated delinquent accounts. And this is the part where we go through the graphics that I'd like to remember that there's two different components here. We have our regular receivables process, which we process, and we have our liquidated delinquent accounts, which, if you'd like, you can think of it as the worst of the worst of the receivables. So in Exhibit A, we talk about how liquidated delinquent accounts have been processing through the payment pipeline. The large area is the amount of the accounts that are worked by the agencies. And as you can see over the three periods, the amount that's been distributed out to the private collection firms and the use of the other agency account units of the Department of Revenue has increased significantly. The early period was what maybe 12% was being used by those two entities, and now we're seeing almost 33% of the state agency's accounts going to other agency accounts and to private collection firms. Over the same time frame, we're seeing the amount of debt that's being sent out to the private collection firms triple from about $80 million in 1999 to almost $250 million in the most recent period. In Exhibit B, I take that step back and have you look at the receivables and plot those against revenue over the 96 through 2002 time frame. And I believe it shows a pretty good report in that during the time frame here from particularly 99 when our economy started to slow down through 2002, we haven't seen a very significant raise in the amount of receivables on the books. If this thing had gone up significantly, that would have given us highlights to other concerns.
The amount of Patrick, she was recognized.
I'm just trying to, I'm on your Exhibit B, which you just referenced. I'm trying to figure out, what do you mean by net receivables?
Net receivables, in the accounting parlance, is you take your accounts receivables and you reduce those by any type of allowance for doubtful accounts so that you have a net amount.
Doubtful?
Allowance for doubtful accounts.
What does that mean? I guess I don't know what the doubtful accounts terms are.
I'm trying to think of a good analogy. In order to properly present the value of those receivables, you need to account for whatever amounts may not be collectible so that you don't overstate your receivables and thereby overstate your financial statements, much as we saw with WorldCom, Global Crossing, and those types of guys, so that you have a proper amount reported as receivables due to the state.
Representative or Senator Winters?
You know, I have this perplexed, puzzled look on my face because, you know, even if it's doubtful to be collected, isn't it a debt owed? And so I'm trying to really get to how you separate what's a debt owed and you come up with some magical percentage of perhaps they're not going to be collected. On what basis, what assumptions are you making that that won't be collected?
Representative Butler, Senator Winters, it's based on historical data. The proper way to calculate allowance for doubtful accounts is to take into account all the collections that have been made over time. You take your total receivables, and then you look backwards and see what has been collected over time, and then you properly apportion that amount. Your total receivables still remain on your books. You're not reducing that from your books. But as a financial reporting purpose, you are reducing those to the proper amount that would be received.
I guess for me as a policymaker, I would like to know, you know, actually what you have and not the assumption games. Because part of what isn't in here, some of the factors are that before we became aggressive, of course, you may not have had the same kind of collectible history. Because there was a point in time, if you go back to the whole, when we got into in 99, you had some agencies who had limited or no skills in order to collect debt, and they just sat there. And we know that the longer debts stay on the books, the more apt that they're not to be collectible. So I guess it's kind of those factors, to me, I'd like to know what those assumption factors are.
John, we've been given some information from Matt a little bit earlier that said at June 30, 1997, the total receivables owed to the state of Oregon amounted to just over $1.8 billion. If I look at your Exhibit B, by almost any calculation there, that would be at least $2.5 billion in 1977. That's a disparity of $700 million. And then we have the net receivables, which have been reduced for these doubtful accounts. Do you know how much the net reduction was, the doubtful accounts amounted to?
Representative Butler, I can go in and get that information. That's all part of our comprehensive financial report.
And I think we need to have some idea as to why, what constituted the definition of doubtful at that point. Had they filed bankruptcy? Find them through a nationwide search, those kinds of information. I would like to have Representative Patrick's recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is, too, if we're looking at this over a historical trend, we've just put the collection agency stuff into place. So hopefully we're collecting a little bit. I mean, that's what the legislature's been working on. And if we're working over a historical basis as to what doubtful accounts are, we're comparing, it's not, at least I don't feel like at least it's a good comparable for what doubtful accounts are versus what's being collected. So I too would like to know what the factors are in those doubtful. I mean, I guess there are things, I'm taking it, that we would normally all write off at business, but I don't know how long you age them or any of the other factors that go on. So that would be.
And an aging would be appropriate, and I think perhaps Senator Winters may have some of that aging information. But also that aging of those
Wait a
others
minute,
doubtful.
How are you?
Be careful,
Senator. This was your forte in the front.
Okay, that's you
were the person that should have had all of that doubtful information. Representative Johnson.
I'll ask you a question. Save you from yourself, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me.
Going farther.
Thank you.
I share my colleague's interest, but I think I heard you answer Senator Winter's question by saying you're not looking at individual accounts. You're looking at the amalgamation and then factoring in some historical and doing a computation based on the totality of the accounts rather than looking at individual accounts.
Representative Butler, Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, that's precisely what we're doing. We're looking at this as an amalgamation. It's an accounting process so that we can take the information from a general perspective and accurately reflect the revenues that are due the state. That does not mean we disregard those receivables. It only means from a financial perspective, this is the expected receivable.
And that's all hunky-dory, but I think we're traveling on two parallel tracks here. I at least sense from my colleagues, and certainly reflecting my own feelings about this, I think it's fine that you have the integrity in your accounting process to do this mass discount. But I think we're all interested in collections and proceeding expeditiously with trying to use all the tools at our disposal to garner those assets that are due the state.
Chairman Butler and Representative Johnson, the reason I point this out is to show that there is a large receivable to revenue implication and to show that how the economy has impacted revenue, overall receivables still remain pretty well collected. We also use this as a indicator against the 7 Western states and 5 major corporations to show that our numbers are relatively in line with all those other entities with regards to our receivables.
Well, respectfully, that's dandy, too. I'd like us to be exemplary.
Other questions for Mr. Frank? Susan?
I had a couple
more.
Oh, I'm
sorry. You did have one more. Exhibit C. I beg your pardon.
If I might.
And Exhibit D.
Exhibit C shows one of the misconceptions that's often received, particularly by the press, is that this $1 billion represents general fund money. And clearly, it is not general fund money. This graphic here shows that how it's broken out into other funds, pass-through funds. There is a significant portion with the Department of Revenue, which would be general fund. But outside of the general fund, there's only 3%, collection by the Department of Revenue, there's only 3% that would be general fund money. And then 26% is federal fund.
Mr.
Federal fund would be some sort of Department of Human Resources.
Probably a large portion.
Senator Winters?
I think that's all well and good, but even I think the taxpayers view it, even whether it's federal or state, it's taxpayers' dollars. And I think from my perspective, when a debt is owing, a debt is to be paid. And so I think it's well to see, only 3% is general fund, but also federal dollars have a direct impact on what we're doing in Oregon. And I think when you look at the child support issue, and that's probably where the bulk of those federal dollars are, that has a direct correlation, because when you don't collect that, state support somehow is given someplace else that has to be repaid. So I just have to clarify that for the record and say it is taxpayers' dollars, it is dollars that are owed, and there are correlation between the federal tax dollar and the state tax dollar.
Excellent. And Exhibit D?
Finally, in Exhibit D, the one line here that I wanted to point out again was under the state agency inventory net. It's often said that the debt is not going down, and we show that the net amount at the state agency level is only $758 million compared to $812 million the previous year. So we are seeing the impacts of House Bill 3509 starting to pay off in a reduction of the amount of inventory held at the net level.
Can you, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can you provide us with the discount percentage on the global? If you're doing a discount, you're doing this on net, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is from the Legislative Fiscal Office report. This is the gross amount.
Okay. Very good. I'll retract my question.
So the state agencies went from $679 million in 2000. Up to 812, and then down to 758. Those are all consistent figures.
The Chair Butler, the reason for the rise there in 2001, if you see the asterisk, is because the Department of, the Judicial Department began reporting in that year. So that increased the original debt by over $300
million. Mr. Chair, but can I answer?
Excuse me, just to make a follow-up. Then in 2002, that debt is there, but it's being collected down.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Senator Winters.
Can you provide us with break out the categories where you show education? Because I can recall in some of our discussions in past history that higher ed was a bit reluctant to become a part of this whole acceleration of collecting debt. And what has been the history of higher ed? I'm just curious as to whether they have been showing the same kinds of trends as some of the other agencies in getting their collections into Department of Revenue.
Chair Butler and Senator Winters, yes, I'd be happy to provide you that data. What I can tell you is that we work closely with the Oregon University system. They have representatives at almost every one of our meetings about accounts receivable and collection methodologies. The university system was very kind in sharing their contracts with us when we redid our contract last year. And we are putting together a group to look at the use of the other agency accounts unit and how we might gain some efficiency there. And they have also graciously accepted to be on that committee as well. So from a participatory standpoint, I can say that they've done very well. I can prepare the data that you've indicated and provide that to you.
I think it would be follow-up, Mr. Chair. I think it would be interesting to see what agencies overall are doing. Like, I know that the bigger ones were, human services and education and Department of Justice. So those three, I think, would be interesting to see what's happening, as well as business and commerce.
Thank you. Susan?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Susan Browning with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and we shared information with all of you when we did our budget process, but I did want to come speak on House Bill 3023. It does have a major impact on the Department of Revenue as administrator of the personal income tax and the other tax programs in the state. We do collect about $9 billion per biennium from taxpayers who owe debt, including delinquent taxes and taxes owed by non-filers. So that's the total $9 billion is the collection through personal income tax. But that also includes delinquent debt and the non-filers that we talked about with you earlier. And the department also provides collection services for the other agencies through the other agency accounts program. And that's targeting about $60 million per biennium. I wish it were $60 billion, but $60 million per biennium through that program. This bill, House Bill 3023, does impact Department of Revenue, its tax programs. It will reduce our 1 year down to 90 days. 90 days really does not give the department enough time to use the tools and to collect the debt. But we've been working with Department of Administrative Services, and Section 6 of the bill does allow the department to work with Department of Administrative Services to address the accounts that we have and the issues we have in extending the time for collection of debt with the Department of Revenue. Obviously not to exceed 1 year as it stands right now. But the Department of Revenue does have extensive tools that you've given us that the private collection agencies don't have. And we're working all the time to try to better our collection rate. Right now it's about 20%. We're getting for the tax programs, and it's about 8% for other agency accounts collection on behalf of the other state programs. And right now we're getting about a 2% return on the total liquidated account, delinquent accounts that we have out of private collection agencies. But we are working to continue making sure those accounts get out there speedily to them as well, and improve our process to get accounts out to them electronically and get the accounts back electronically and do a lot of that part of the process as well. So this
Susan,
bill
let me
does...
Just ask a question. Excuse me for interrupting. I just want to make absolutely certain that the 1 year is sufficient time within which the Department of Revenue has access to all of its collection avenues to which to which the law applies are open to the Department of Revenue, that's sufficient time before you turn it over to the collection, to the Department of Administrative Services?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have been operating under the one-year guideline under House Bill 3509, and thanks to Senator Winters and Senator Butler, I think that was a good tool for the state agencies to move debt. So we have been operating on the 1 year. If we get no payment, we do turn it over to a private collection agency. We have now set a time frame in our contracts with the private collection agencies that after 2.5 years, if they don't get any collection, they need to send it back to us, and then we attempt to collect it again or send it out to another private collection.
Do we have any experience, because of the newness of the law, do we have any experience of the 2.5 years and receiving those accounts back?
The percentage collection rate we have is about 2% right now on them.
On those other 2.5 years?
On total, okay. Mr. Chair, total accounts. We did have a lot, some older accounts, some problem accounts that have gone out to private collection agencies. So we're hoping the collection rate from the private collection agencies will go out as they clear out the backlog of the old accounts and start circling those through. They have been returning quite a few accounts to us, and we're looking at
greater
again
than the 2%, you think, Susan?
Oh, they've been sending, I have some information for you here, Mr. Chair.
What I'm after is the private industry doing a better job than the Department of Revenue had been doing on those delinquent accounts.
Mr. Chair, to give you an idea, 2002, the inventory of accounts we had out at private collection agencies was $50 million. We added about $29 million out to the private collection. They returned about $1.5 million, and they collected about 2% of the total they had out there, of the $78 million.
Representative Patridge.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I think we're looking at apples and oranges, though. The accounts that they send out to private collection agencies are the tough accounts that the Department of Revenue has already tried. In addition,
yes,
I think the collection agencies have been hamstrung by the fact that they couldn't proceed to get a judgment against the debtor, and consequently then that substantially hamstrings somebody if you can't go out and you're basically just chasing them without a big stick. You keep chasing them around and around. My understanding is now that issue is resolved so that they can actually go out and proceed against the debtors. So I think I would hope that would jump our collection efforts rather substantially. As a private business, we would never turn our bad debts over to a collection agency without letting them move forward and sue. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. I think in addition to that, with the passage of House Bill 2055, I don't know why DAS or the department would necessarily even be worried about the 90-day window of opportunity, because the state will be made whole as a result of the efforts of the private collection agencies. They won't take a portion off the top of that. So, I mean, I think House Bill 3023 may have been an issue in regard to the 90-day timeline had House Bill 2055 not been in effect. But now that it's in effect, I don't see why we should be worried, because the state will be made whole and the private collection agencies will not be taking a portion of it. In fact, we may actually see, at least in my opinion, a net gain, because we're actually, if they're turning them over quicker and the private collection agencies are able to receive the cost of collection as a result of what goes on, we may be able to skinny up staffing and other things at Department of Revenue or other places, because we're now allowing a private collection agency to collect those debts plus the cost of collection. So I guess I don't necessarily see the conclusions that were reached in the letter from DAS, or do I have concerns with Department of Revenue as a result of the kind of all the levers that are out there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, if I may respond. You have a key point. The 2% collection rate is on very, very, very difficult accounts to collect. And those are the kind of accounts that we send out to private collection agencies. Out of state, those we've worked very thoroughly, because it's our job to work thoroughly within the 1 year period to get collection. And we have tools that private collection agencies and many other state agencies don't have as well. One of the key tools we have is the ability to do administrative warrants and garnishments. And as part of that, there's a clock that runs that requires notification to the taxpayer, because you're basically seizing their salary, seizing their wages. We can take their money in their checking or their bank accounts. And as part of that, we need to locate the taxpayer, verify their address, do all that, send them a demand letter. They have 30 days to respond by law, and we give them 15 days in the mail. Then we have to get the warrant out there, locate their employer if they're employed, and act on that. And if they're paid only monthly, we may have missed their pay cycle. So that's all required just to get an involuntary payment from someone who is not cooperating with us. That's taking the very involuntary route, too. Once we start warranting and garnishing, we will get a person's attention, almost guaranteed, and we can work with them to get a pay plan. Part of what we do with the tax program is kind of unique as well, is that, excuse me, boy,
sure. I'm pretty familiar with the process.
Okay.
I'm the general counsel of a company that has about 4,000 employees in various states. I think I'm pretty familiar with the process. I just was making a comment on that.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you. Senator Winters?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the agency does well. With what we're dealing with currently, we're looking at percentages, are old accounts. Because before the legislation, there were accounts sitting there that were 10, 5, 10. I mean, the older the account is, the more difficult it is to collect. I used to be in skip racing, so, you know,
yes.
It was one of my other hacks a long time
ago.
That's
how our family met, wasn't it?
I think so. That's right. Yeah. We're aging and we're skipping out. I think in trying to do apples to oranges isn't really fair because those accounts, before the legislation was passed, were terribly old. They've been sitting on the books for an awfully long time, and to have to try to, you know, we were lucky if we got 1%, I thought, out of those accounts because they were so aged, and trying to skip trace and find those individuals, I think, was a huge undertaking. And that being said, I think the sooner that we can get activity done on accounts, the probability of increasing the revenue that anyone who works in this particular field knows that's the outcome. Because you're able to get the person before they go, not necessarily into hiding, but before they've come to the mindset that I'm not paying that debt. I don't care what the state says. I don't care what, you know, anybody says. And whatever, even the court remedies, as you know, people go into hiding. So I guess for me, and looking at the bill that speeds it up, that any way we can all work together to speed up this process, I think it is a plus for the state of Oregon, and it's a plus for our general fund. Even those federal dollars are a plus. And I think that somehow looking at how can we make the 90 days a reality, because you're actually talking about an account, even at 6 months, my suspicion is that by the time the agency, the person has sent in $5, and you know as well as I do that if you collect $1, that the account stays active. You know, you're no longer delinquent once you accept that. So you can play the dollar game for a long period of time before you actually get it into where you're going to collect. And so we're talking a time element here. And I share Debbie Patrick said, I think we can speed this up, and I hope that the agency would look at how we can make this happen from a year to 6 months. I'm just interested in getting the debt collected.
Mm-hmm. Chair Butler, Senator Winters, Department of Revenue totally agrees. We were neutral on this bill and wanted to work through Section 6 of the bill with the Department of Administrative Services to address the types of taxes and tax debt and issues the Department of Revenue has.
And at this point, Susan, you believe that it does, Section 6 does address your concern?
Section 6, I was speaking with our director on this, and she says if we can work with the Department of Administrative Services and get exemption for our accounts and work on the OAA, other agency accounts, we do.
Thank you very much. Representative Patridge is working with Legislative Council on the concerns as they relate to 2055. Is that right? 2055, the fix on the governor's letter of expressed concerns. And so what we'll do, Dallas, is the decision of the chair at this time to just go ahead and hold this over, and we won't hold it over to tomorrow, but we'll need to repost it until we get back the information from the from Legislative Council, and we'll depend upon Representative Patrick to work with the collections folks and we'll continue to work on it. With that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3023. Thank you very much. And we'll then open a public hearing and a work session on House Bill 2341 relating to public contracting.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2341 is a bill that's a result of interim work done by a task force on revamping or streamlining some of the procurement code to make life a little easier for all involved. This bill, again, was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We've got the co-chairs okay to go ahead and work it, and I'll go check the sign-up list for those. Please.
Okay, we have Jessica Harris signed up from Associate General Contractors. Jessica?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris. I'm here on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in strong support of this bill. This bill has had a long journey to get to you. This bill is the product of an interim work group chaired by Representative Bill Girard, who was appointed to a work group by the Speaker as a result of the passage of a bill, H.R. 1, that was passed last session. A stakeholder group was created. I'm here also in the capacity as a co-chair of that stakeholder group that worked long and hard to put this bill together. What this bill does, quite briefly, is divide the current 279 into essentially four chapters. Current 279 is retained, and there are provisions related to products and services of disabled individuals. Current ORS 279-835-855 that are retained in current 279. 279A that will be overarching provisions, definitions, minority women business enterprise, state procurement requirements, those kinds of things that will be in 279A that govern both 279B and 279C. 279B will address everything but construction. Essentially, it's computers, it's cars, it's pencils, it's insurance, anything that isn't construction. And 279C is architect and engineering, public works, and public improvement construction laws. The deal essentially was that 279C, the construction aspect, public improvement aspect, there were no changes made to that statute unless there was complete industry consensus, which has been reached, and those in the construction community and in the agency community have maintained the deal that things in C work well for construction and public improvements. The things that they didn't work well for were things like information technology purchases, regular RFP purchases, and that's why 279B was created. It now allows outright authority from a menu of options for things like a request for proposal, a process for which was not in current 279. It retains the current process slightly revamped for hard bid. It also allows for a myriad of other options, including a quote process. This bill is a good government bill. It's a good business bill. It will enable agencies to more effectively acquire what they need to do their business and enable the private sector to more easily access the public procurement process.
Thank you. Questions for Jessica? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I discussed this with Jessica before. Early in February, I received two letters from an individual concerned about some discussion concerning products of disabled individuals, and I understand that those issues have been resolved to the satisfaction of everyone, and that's what you assured to me, and Nanheim is shaking her head back there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct, and if I may, Representative Butler, I would like to just for the record say that there are a myriad of issues that are still on the table, including provisions for the City of Eugene, provisions on legal remedies, provisions that are still being negotiated with E-Web and Boley. Excuse me, now I owe $2. The Eugene
well,
Water
you've got
and
RFP
Court.
As well. So.
One to three. I should have just brought it up with me. The Eugene Water Electric Board and the Bureau of Labor and Industries that are still in negotiation. There are provisions that remain for the public utility districts. Those are still issues that we have made commitments on. Those issues are substantive enough and there would require amendment large enough that we have reached agreement with the parties to do those amendments in a substantive committee on the Senate side. We have assurances from the leadership office of the Senate that they will refer the bill to a substantive committee on the Senate side once it reaches there.
Further questions for Jessica? Thank you very much, Jessica. David Barenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is David Barenberg from the League of Oregon Cities, and I am doing a poor imitation of our staff person, Linda Ludwig, who has put many hours working on this, but who unfortunately is sitting in a dentist's chair as this meeting is moving forward. Just quickly wanted to add, essentially say we agree with everything that Jessica said before us, and just wanted to raise two points. One is that there is a cost to cities in implementing this, but we do believe that the bill will provide long-term benefits that will far exceed the cost of implementing this legislation. And then second, as she had stated, that there's work going on the legal remedy section, which is very important to us, and we're very confident we'll be able to address in a substantive committee on the Senate side. And with that, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you, Dave. It's my understanding that this bill then does need some technical amendments regarding public utility districts and other municipalities. I guess I need just a little bit of assurance that that's going to be done when we pass it out here.
Mr. Chair, I did a very good job of avoiding being our representative to the work group, and Linda has been, and they have got to know each other very well through many hours of meeting, and I think there's a very high level of trust among participants, and the commitments will be carried through.
Okay, so we're feeling comfortable. On behalf of the city, League of Oregon City, yes. You're saying that you will, and Jessica Harris, on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, has indicated that they're willing to participate in that. Counties, special districts? Okay, I see those folks shaking their heads yes. I think I'm going to get you on the record if I could. Is anyone going to come up? I'm going to come up and make sure that we get that logged into the record. I just hesitate to turn loose of this and with everybody understanding that everybody's going to cooperate and be good Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. Please.
Chairman Butler, members of the committee, John O'Shell with the Association of Oregon Counties. Association of Oregon County very strongly supports this bill, strongly supports the amendments that will be proposed on the other side.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We do have some concerns and are waiting to see the final section of the legal remedies portion. That's very important to us also. And I assure you that if we are not excited about what happens on the in the Senate Substantive Committee, you will hear from us. We've been working very well together just in trying to work through a number of issues, and we expect to be able to reach conclusion.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you two may not be the two to ask, but with respect to who all has been at the table, I heard the chair mention PUDs. Are there any other issues that you're aware of with cooperatives or any other outstanding besides the folks that have just been ticked off here, special districts, cities, counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I know at one point the Oregon Association of Public Utility Districts did have some concerns in the House Business Committee. I, if I recall correctly, their concerns were addressed.
They need to be Senate side. We made that commitment.
So Ms. Harris is indicating that that's part of the amendment on the Senate side.
Okay. Thank you. And the unions, do we have any references? Jessica, do you want to let us know what the status is there? Again, if we move this to full and on out to the House floor, gets fast on the House floor, and then we run into problems. So, Jessica?
Yes. Chair Butler, members of the committee, again, for the record, this is Jessica Harris with the Associated General Contractors. Yes, we have agreement with the unions, both of the building trade sector that has been highly involved with the bill, and we have had at least some initial talks with public employees unions for which there were questions about whether or not this involved any contracting out language, which they might be concerned about. The goal of this was to be policy neutral with respect to things that were highly divisive, and so we have not included any of that changes to the language that's already there.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jessica, you're appearing now as the expert, so I got one more for you. I know that early on the professional services folks had raised a lot of questions. Can you speak to whether or not their issues are adequately resolved to their satisfaction?
Chair Butler, Representative Johnson, and I am more than happy to. Gary Conkling is, by the way, in the room and can also speak to the professional services issue. But we talked with them, and they are comfortable. In fact, the issue that they raised about whether or not a tie bid preference, and that's when two bids come in and one is from an out-of-state company and one is from an in-state company. If those bids are exactly the same and they're both low, in terms of the cost is the lowest provided to the agency, then the Oregon company is the one that gets the preference. In the past, it hasn't applied to professional services folks like lawyers and others. We, through a change, have fixed their issue, and it does now apply to them, and the last I heard, they are in support of this bill.
I see Mr. Conkling's head going up and down, too, so thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, I appreciate it. It appears that there is some substantial agreement here. We are in work session. The motion before us is to move House Bill 2341A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, recognizing that there is some technical work that needs to be done over on the Senate side, assuming it gets past the House side at that particular point. The piggy bank is taking the name, Jessica?
Yes, this is harder than it looks. This is why they don't actually let me do construction.
We'll make sure that the hole at the top of the piggy bank gets. Representative Johnson, you've been very successful in getting money into that piggy bank. American Cancer Society appreciates it.
Mr. Chair, if you need a motion, also move. We need to get to
okay.
The floor.
The motion has been made to push House Bill 2341A to the full committee with due pass recommendation. Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Representative Johnson, will you carry, Representative, or Senator Winters, will you carry that? Representative Johnson, would you like to carry that on
sure.
The floor? Okay, thank you.
Gerard.
Well, yeah,
that's a great idea.
Probably Bill Gerard and note that he can get
Bill Gerard on to the House.
With that, we will close, and we do have one item for tomorrow, as previously indicated, for carryover. With that, we'll see you tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you.